Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome to the new year and the new decade. You have arrived at the intersection of common and economic sense, and that together makes Green Sense. Bob Kessler, executive producer, combs the globe to find us the best guests that have innovations that can help us build a more sustainable society. Bob, what are we going to learn this week?
Well, we'll get to that in a second, but you've been doing some global travel of your own. Am I hearing a slight raspy sound to your voice? You've been doing a lot. You've been on the road. You've been in the air.
Well, you have those fine-tuned ears, Bob. I just recently got back from Hong Kong, and one of the advantages of international travel is that it gives you a really good perspective. And being in Hong Kong for the New Year's, they stopped the fireworks because of the protesters. And I also noticed that there were no fireworks in Australia, which usually kicks off the fireworks as they go around the globe for the new year. And the fireworks were stopped because of the hundreds of forest fires in the country. And I think that's very representative of where we're at in the world, is either we have political unrest because of policies that don't work, or we have unrest because of climate change. We're kicking off the roaring 20s, and it's up to all of us to change things, because I don't think our politicians can. So what do we have this week, Bob, that can help people learn how to change things and make the world a little more sustainable?
Well, sometimes the source of that unsustainability can be just human beings and how we interact with little tiny things. Now, these things I'm talking about, they're no longer than a few inches. They move only a few meters a year, but they could have a big impact on the climate. So we'll find out about that. Of course, we are a solution-based kind of place. We're not just here to tell you about the problem. So we'll learn about both the problem and some potential solutions.
Well, those solutions are coming up on this edition of Green Sense. Earthworms, which are beneficial to the soil in some areas, are now heading into places like the northern forests of Canada and the U.S., and they're disturbing the soil and transforming ecosystems. It could result in large amounts of carbon stored in the ground to be released into the atmosphere. Justine Lehole is one of the researchers with the University of Alberta who's been looking into the phenomenon of global warming and joins us now on Green Sense. Justine, welcome to Green Sense.
Hi, thank you, Robert.
So this is happening in boreal forests in the U.S. and Canada. First, can you define just briefly, what is a boreal forest and how does it differ from other forests?
So the boreal forests are the forests that we find, like the most northern forest on Earth. So we're talking high latitudes compared to temperate forests. It means it's colder, and mainly the dynamics of the boreal forests are mainly linked to temperature and the fact that low temperatures are limiting plant growth and also decomposition. So
do you have different types of trees that grow in boreal forests versus other?
So there are two types of, there are coniferous trees such as pines and spruce, and we also have forests that are more deciduous, mainly with trembling aspen.
So these boreal forests in the U.S. and Canada are considered a carbon sink. How important is that function for the climate and life on Earth?
So in terms of importance of the boreal forest, it represents a third of the forest that we find on Earth. And in terms of carbon storage, it also corresponds to about a third of the carbon that is stored in the terrestrial ecosystems. So those northern forests are very important for carbon storage, and especially the soil of those forests, because we find 95% of the total carbon in the soil and not in the living biomass. To give a comparison, tropical forests store more than 50% in the living biomass, so in trees. And in the boreal forest, we have most of it underground.
Ah, that's a unique distinction. And when did earthworms start to live in these more northern areas?
So to give a bit of background, they were originally native species that have been completely killed with the last glaciation. So the end of the last glaciation was about 12,000 years before present. And since then, those ecosystems have been developing without earthworms until European settlement. So this was a while ago, but the first mentions that we have of those earthworms in the boreal itself are only from the early 2000s. So that's pretty recent.
And with all that carbon capture in the ground, why weren't earthworms there before?
Because as I said, with the glaciation, they were just completely killed, eradicated from the area. So there were no worms available for dispersion. So the characteristic of those boreal forests is a very thick organic layer that's on the surface because there is no fauna to actually mix it with the underlying soil.
So Justine, if you could help us understand, when the worms come, how do they release carbon into the atmosphere, and how big of an issue is this?
So there are different mechanisms happening there. It also depends on the kind of earthworm that we have. But broadly speaking, earthworm are going to eat the organic layer that's on the surface. That's mainly leaf decomposing leaves from the trees. So they're eating it, and with the process of eating it, it's just as us when we, like, just the fact that we're living, we are respiring and we're releasing CO2 into the atmosphere. So that process is similar for the earthworms too, but then they also enhance microbial activity in the soil, which also leads to more CO2 released. So it's both a direct and indirect effects.
Justine, where were these worms before they moved to the boreal forests?
These worms are coming from Europe mainly. In the boreal at this stage, they're only European species. I know for a fact that in temperate forests in the States, we also have Asian species, but they're not in the boreal yet. So they were all coming with boats from Europe. When soil is displaced, earthworms are also used as fishing baits. And as soon as we move soil, there is a high chance that we're also moving earthworm eggs with it. So that's how the dispersion is occurring.
Where these earthworms were originally located, were they releasing carbon when they were eating the organic material?
So, yes, they are releasing carbon. It doesn't matter if they're native or invasive species. They have the same impact in terms of CO2 release. But the big difference is that in the forests that have been developing with those worms, the dynamic has been the same and is remaining the same. So it's not a big of an issue, that big of an issue there. Because it's part of the ecosystem. The problem in the boreal is that they're invading and they're changing all those dynamics, that especially with the organic layer I was mentioning earlier, because that's where most of the carbon is stored. And it's not the case in those forests where they've always been.
Can you put this in context? How many worms have been migrated to these boreal forests? And how big of a problem is this?
So in terms of number of worms, it really depends on the area. I know in Alberta, in the province of Alberta, where I do most of my field work, we mainly have one species in the boreal, but it doesn't mean that other species are not going to join them later. I think it really depends on the area, but there are between 8 and 20 species identified in the boreal at this stage. The problem is that they're releasing a lot of carbon from the soil, and according to preliminary calculations that I made with my supervisor, Sylvie Kido, we are talking same amount as what is released with wildfires every year.
Well, that's pretty significant. Is there ways to arrest or reverse the process?
That's a good question, and it's hard to give an answer to this because it's a very complex process, and there are many ways that those earthworms are being dispersed in the boreal. There have been a few initiatives, at least to encourage anglers to dispose of the remaining worms after fishing in dedicated bins instead of just dumping them near the shore. But it's just an encouragement, and there is no actual legal restriction concerning earthworms at this stage. There is also people advocating for less road construction and reduced traffic. But at this stage, we also know that human activities in the boreal are increasing. So I don't see how that could be possible to implement. Completely arresting the process is not really something we can do because they're there already and it's hard to stop them, but we can try and at least slow down the process.
Is this part of evolution or is this man-made?
So in this specific case, it's mainly man-made because in terms of natural rates of dispersion, earthworms can travel a few meters a year. We're talking 5 to 10 meters depending on the species. So if it was only natural, they wouldn't be that far north. So it's mainly because of human activities that they're making their way through the boreal.
So are you able to quantify the extent of the problem, or is that what your research is focused on?
My research is more focusing on the actual dynamics with carbon storage, but there are also researchers looking more at the ecological aspect of it. Maybe I haven't mentioned it yet, but compared to temperate forests, we have very limited information available for the boreal. So we need more research, and to understand the extent of this invasion, we need to be in the field and have more data. But this is really time-consuming work we're talking about. We have estimates for some parts of the boreal. For instance, in Alberta, we estimate that there is currently about 9% of the forests that's invaded. And by 2050, because of road construction mainly, we're expecting about 50% of the forest to be invaded, but just for the province of Alberta.
If you were queen for a day, how would you resolve this problem?
That's a very interesting question. I honestly don't think we have an answer to how we can solve this problem. Limiting human activities in the boreal would be a first step, but I also know that it's not the way we're going right now. So I think solving the problem is not something we can manage, but we should at least understand the processes and in terms of budgeting for carbon storage in the boreal, we should take that into account, those mechanisms into account.
Well, thank you for joining us on GreenSense, and we wish you luck on your research and would welcome you back to share your findings.
Thank you very much.
That's Justine Lejoulet with the University of Alberta telling us about global warming. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. Even though we may take them for granted, a healthy insect population as part of the ecosystem, and they're critical for life on Earth. We hear about insects dying off because of pesticides, climate change, or other causes we don't yet understand. And one of those factors just might be light pollution. That is artificial light from homes and buildings. And Dr. James Carl Fisher is the executive director of the Zoological Lighting Institute and joins us now to tell us about the latest research. Dr. Fisher, thanks for joining us on GreenSense.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very happy to be here.
I didn't even know that there was an institute dedicated to zoological lighting. How long has the institute been around?
Well, you're not alone. We've been around for about 8 years now. We started taking care of animals in zoos and aquariums and moved into wildlife conservation issues very soon after.
And we know that light affects biorhythms, so understanding how it impacts plants and animals is very important. So help us understand why healthy insect populations are critical for life on Earth.
Well, you know, insects are central to life, actually. They serve as food sources. They help us pollinate plants, food. And they serve as food themselves. So, you know, without insects, none of an ecosystem can function at this stage. They're that important. They really sit at the heart of all life needs to function properly.
They bite us. They pass on disease. And so for many of us, we consider them as pesky. Explain to us why and how important they are to the ecosystem and why that bite and the disease that they spread is insignificant, or you tell us how that fits into the big picture.
Sure. Oh, I would say it's incredibly significant. You know, managing insects properly so they don't spread disease among humans and our, you know, families, you know, that's a very big big deal. You know, making sure that insects don't destroy crops, that's a very big deal. The question is, how do you manage that? Because, you know, insects, it's a little bit ironic. You know, insects are necessary to help people produce food, right? Because they pollinate. When they die, their nutrients go back into the soil. They're very important in that process. And so, you know, even though there are challenges with pesticides because they have direct, you know, health consequences too, they're necessary, you know, to manage an overall program of living with insects properly. The problem comes with light pollution in particular is that one, it'll draw insects into places where they wouldn't normally be, and so you would increase diseases in communities. But then on the other side, you know, it's kind of an incidental kill. You know, you tend to kill off beneficial insects that do help with pollination, or that, you know, feed birds or feed you know, other animals in the system. So there's a, you know, there's a kind of a common sense management that needs to happen with living with insects. You know, those bites, you know, that is a part of life. You know, that we do live with wildlife, and it's not always pleasant, but it's necessary, you know, for the overall health of communities to, you know, to succeed and to thrive.
At what rates are insects dying off? And what are the causes? Yeah, what are the main causes, sure, too?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, habitat loss, you know, you'll hear this in general with wildlife conservation. Habitat loss, you know, or toxins in the environment, you know, in general, those are big issues because, you know, to survive, insects, they have to breed like anything else. So, and to do that, they need places where they would normally breed, so soils and, you know, healthy streams and rivers and so on and so forth. But because development and architecture, quite frankly, hasn't taken wildlife into account, it means that decisions aren't often based in good information. So we tend to lose the things that insects need to survive. Now, with light pollution, this latest paper that you know, several of our board members you know, wrote and Biologic Conservation published. You know, that paper identifies, it refers to over 200 papers that show how light and natural light in particular is important for insects, and why the modifications to the natural light environment are so deadly. I don't want to go on too long, but that's one of the main purposes of the Zoological Lighting Institute, you know, our zoolighting.org site. It is really to show the different ways in that light affects living things.
James, can that be a positive and be turned around? If we know that lighting is impacting the mortality rate of insects, can we use that to control them?
I think so, but the challenge is, though, it has to be done in a very careful way, because the lighting tends to, artificial lighting, it tends to affect the beneficial insects and really promote pests. That's really the irony in all of this. So, for example, with something like streetlights and mosquitoes, you know, you tend to draw in the disease-bearing insects, but animals like dragonflies and whatnot, they tend to be killed off by them because of the modifications, the reduction in diversity. Sorry, that's the best way to say it. The artificial lighting, it's a very difficult concept sometimes to get to, but artificial lighting, it tends to reduce the complexity of the environment. It takes what normally is, you know, subtly dark, and it makes it into the same kind of lighting mush everywhere, you know, so like straight, you know, the same conditions everywhere. And when you do that, you lose that wide range of habitat lighting as habitat that would be beneficial, you know, to many species that tend to control each other. So integrated pest management is the term that, you know, folks like Disney will promote. That integrated pest management really requires a more natural environment to thrive. So, you know, as far as controlling insects with artificial light, it's not a great idea.
Let me challenge you on that. We run an indoor vertical farm in a controlled environment, and we have an integrated pest management strategy. And what we have found is using different LED light frequencies, you can retract or repel different types of insects. Since we grow pesticide free, we're finding that manipulating the different frequency in the photo period can have impact on insects as a way to reduce them without using biological predators or pesticides. So as I said, I think that there's a positive out of this, but the story's not about us, it's about you. So tell us more about, you know, how much of the insect population is lost to light pollution.
You know, overall, let me just start with that. A controlled environment, though, is very different from, say, an outdoor farm.
Definitely.
Very different scenario. Right. And so, you know, in terms of, you know, managing a controlled environment like that, I'm all for it. You know, absolutely. You know, and trying to understand what those specific processes are is incredibly valuable. So I just want to say that, too. I see that, and I believe in that wholeheartedly. You know, what I would say, though, you know, on this, you know, on the, like some of the effects that we might talk about, if that makes sense to say, talk about that for a second.
Sure.
Okay. With artificial light, you know, or any light, let's just say any light in general, it really has a role in the development of the insects as juveniles. You know, we often don't think of, you know, like an insect growing, right? You know, but natural light actually has a fundamental role, and it's very low intensity. You know, and you know, there are papers coming out of the biophoton research side of things that will show how subtle that light is. So that growth and you know, basic hormone cycling within the insect themselves as they're growing, reproducing, and so on and so forth. That's one aspect. Another aspect, and you know, really our second category, is how you know, insects process light. You know, how do they see?
So let me just summarize. I think you've made a great point here that insects, as we all know, are part of the ecosystem, and they're an important part of the food chain, and that artificial light can impact their environment, which reduces their population. So it's an important thing to recognize that cause and effect, something that we really haven't thought much about as a society. So what can everyday people do to help the insects and promote more of a natural ecosystem?
Well, I think, you know, an everyday person, things like turning off porch lights. That's the first thing. If someone has a home and they have porches, just turn them off. You know, there's a feeling of security around lighting that it's not actual. You know, it doesn't actually protect anyone. Like a little kid, you know, and it doesn't actually protect. So the idea of turning those off or lowering them, you know.
Or put them on motion detectors. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, they don't need to be on all night, right? That's kind of the point there. So that's one thing. And the other, I would say, is to look for alternative ways to solve problems rather than adding light. Light's radiation, right? So it might mean that, you know, changing the timing of activities, if it's possible, is a good thing. You know, so or encouraging, you know, and, you know, there's the individual person themselves, ourselves, right? We can turn off lights whenever we have a chance and, you know, get used to living at natural night. Getting out and enjoying the environment, promoting, as you know, you guys do, you know, promoting pesticide-free foods, you know, organic foods. But then looking at light as a pollutant, you know, once you start looking at light as radiation and you start trying to see the stars again or walk under a moon without artificial lights perfectly, you know, we've done it for thousands of years. And there's no reason why we can't figure out new ways to do that now. Those kind of things make a more natural environment free of artificial light much more comfortable. And I think, you know, anxiety is really the first thing people have to, they have to work to get over that. And that's difficult sometimes. But that's always our first suggestion, you know, go watch the fireflies, you know, or encourage fireflies in the yard. You know, looking at dragonflies, trying to appreciate that beauty of the light in their wings, you know, how, and try to think about, well, what is light doing?
That's Dr. James Carl Fisher, Executive Director of the Zoological Lighting Institute, talking about light pollution and insect populations. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.